Well, Brent is gay, and Kaylin's gay, and Clark is gay, and Ryan's gay, and Adam's gay. It's Homo Superior.
Welcome to another Homo Superior Creator Crush. I'm Kaylin Bhatia, and co-hosting with me today is our very own Scream Queen, Brent Wingate. Hi, Brent.
Hi, I'm Brent Wingate.
Creator Crush is an interview series where we chat with our favorite comic book creators, learning more about their work, their thoughts in the industry, and what makes them so darn special. Today, we are so excited to have Jordan White, senior editor of the X Books at Marvel, and one of the major architects of the beloved and sadly soon to end Krakoa era. Also, little homos, you may not know this. He's also a huge Sailor Moon fan, plays the ukulele, and has a horror podcast called Nature Trail to Hell. Jordan, thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
All right, we're going to just jump right into it. I myself have been reading the X-Men for over 30 years. I just aged myself. And I got to say, the last 5 years have been among the best, if not the best, the X-Books have ever been, in my opinion. But I got to ask first, you're definitely a fan. When did you first fall in love with the X-Men?
Well, that's a complicated question, because you put it so emphatically of fall in love with. And I think that's a big distinction, because the truth is, I didn't fall in love with the X-Men that early on. I fell in love with Excalibur. I absolutely adore everything about the original Excalibur run, right up through when Alan Davis left the second time. Well, I don't want to say I love every issue. There's some real clunkers in there, those fill-in issues, but the main run of the Claremont written stuff and then the Alan Davis written stuff was all so terrific, and I really loved it. I went absolutely nuts for those when I started reading those. And through those, I kind of those were my in into the world of X. But the vibe of Excalibur is very different from the vibe of the rest of the X books at the time. And so they didn't grab me the way Excalibur did. I was, as a comic reader, as a young person, I would read any comic you put in front of me. Like, if you, it didn't matter. Any Marvel was my favorite, but if you put a Marvel book in front of me, if you put a DC book in front of me, I'd be like, yeah, of course, I'll read it. It's a comic book. So I would read anything, but I didn't seek out X-Men at the time. I sought out Spider-Man and I sought out Excalibur once I fell in love with it. In the years that followed, I read a lot of X-Men because there was a lot of X-Men. I didn't follow the ongoings regularly. I would say much later, when the Essentials came out, is when I read the Claremont run. So I read them for the first time all in black and white.
The black and white ones, yeah.
Yep. Those were terrific. I mean, because it was they were, I mean, people used to refer to them as phone books. They're enormous. Like, it's so many issues in a row on the pulpy paper. It was a great read. And but I will say my interaction with it was different from that of a lot of people, because I didn't read it as an ongoing that was happening. I read it as, here is this like monumental historic run, that is long over by the time I read it. And I really liked it. I mean, I thought I was like, this is terrific. I see what people see in it. And my favorite part about it was all the Excalibur characters. Was seeing Kitty, was seeing Kurt, was seeing Rachel when she
Rachel,
showed
yeah.
up. And the hints also Betsy, even though she wasn't an Excalibur character, but like, because she was Brian's sister, I was like, oh, what's going on here? The book that actually made me love ongoing X-Men, I'm going to read this book as it comes out every month, was New X-Men, was Grant Morrison. That book absolutely changed everything. And I didn't, again, because I wasn't reading the books regularly, I didn't buy the singles. When the trade came out is when the first trade for E for Extinction, everybody was talking about how great it was. And I was like, all right, let me give it a go. And it absolutely knocked my socks off, and I jumped onto all the X books ongoing at that point. And I think I pretty much bought all of them from then until I started working at Marvel and getting them for free. Because obviously that run was amazing. I was definitely one of the people who was very thrown by the fact that every place where he zigged, Marvel the next month zagged, like going, what happened there? Why did this happen? But then shortly thereafter, it was the Joss Whedon run, which was so great. And you know, there's been so many great people on the X-Men. It's been a blast to follow. I came into the X-Men, and so that's where I really started to really like the X-Men a lot. And then the other place, I will tell you my secret to editing comics is that you have to love the comics you're making, no matter what. And even if you don't love them, you have to find a way. And that's not a comment on the X-Men to say that they're not, if you don't love them. But what I'll say is, well, there's no reason not to be real about it. When I came onto the X-Men the first time as an assistant editor, when I moved from being Mark Panich's assistant editor over in the Hulk office to being Nick Lowe's assistant in the X-Men office, I was at a rough patch for X-Men. I wasn't loving it. I mean, this is nothing against him because he's written some other comics that I think are absolutely astonishingly good, but I wasn't a big fan of Matt Fraction's run. Partially because, like, I'm a person who doesn't love the direction Cyclops went in those years, the like hardcore child army
Revolutionary.
Cyclops. I like to think of it as child army Cyclops, but
Yeah.
revolutionary, I suppose. No, like honestly, like the Bendis revolutionary Cyclops I like more, but the way he was on Utopia, I wasn't big on it. And so it kind of turned me off. But then I moved into the X office and I was like, oh no, they're putting me on these books that I don't think are great. Thankfully, as soon as I came in, they said to me, here's what we're doing. Like, we're about to do this big thing called Schism, and here's what that's about. And I absolutely loved Schism because it played off all the things that made me uncomfortable about Utopia and went, we're gonna simultaneously go against them and lean into them even harder. And that, as much as I absolutely love the Grant Morrison run, like the place that really like locked the X-Men into my heart was working on the books and working on those two books in particular, Jason Aaron's Wolverine and the X-Men and Kieran Gillen's Uncanny X-Men was so wonderful. The two of them are both absolutely amazing. And I think they were at the top of their game at the time. And I mean, there's, I'm not to say they've gone downhill since then, but I mean, like they were absolutely killing it. I loved both of those books for completely different reasons. The Wolverine books, because, and I know it's controversial to be like, Wolverine was against the child soldier thing. It worked for me. It totally worked for me. And him starting the school and
Brave
having like
stance, Wolverine.
it worked for me, and I was super on his side for the schism. And I loved the lighter hearted book. I mean, again, as an Excalibur fan, of course I loved the lighter hearted book. Meanwhile, though, on the other side, Kieran Gillen wrote what I would say is the absolute best Brotherhood of Evil Mutants book ever written, where that scene at the first issue, I think, where is it Storm who goes like, raise your hand if you haven't gone evil, and like only she raises her hand, and everybody else is like, all right, Storm. It was such a great book, and that was the beginning of like my real deep love for the characters, because working on characters. For the bulk of the characters, the first book I ever worked on at Marvel was Chris Claremont's, the very end of Chris Claremont's Exiles and the beginning of New Exiles, which is another place. That's why I love Sage to this day, because I worked closely with Sage on that book. Anyway, so there's multiple answers. Excalibur was my first in. New X-Men was where I started reading the books religiously as a reader, and the deepest part of my love actually came on working on the books. In an era that I absolutely adored.
I feel
How
like
did your
we have a similar trajectory there, Jordan. I got into X-Men when Excalibur first got published, but I got into an Inferno and then kind of dropped off in the late 90s. Morrison brought me back with their run and then kind of dropped off after they were done, and then Schism brought me back in.
There you
So
go.
it's like very we've had parallel lives, but you know, you're the editor for the X books and I'm just, you know, running a podcast.
Not for much longer. Depending on when this comes out, maybe I'm not even. So there you
They may take us off the air as well.
are.
So how
This is
did,
our schism, Jordan.
oh no.
how did your views on, like, because I think a lot of people come into the X-Men for different reasons, different ways. There's obviously lots of different kinds of fandoms that love certain aspects over others. for you as kind of a reader transitioning to an editor who has to quote unquote learn to love the X-Men in a different way, what were some of the things that were most interesting to you as far as why the X-Men are different from, say, the Avengers or some other storyline? Is it like the outsider status? Is it the kinds of characters that they've got in the story? Is it the themes? Where were you viewing, kind of your position changing from non-editor to editor?
Well, good question. I would say, well, first of all, especially at the beginning of my awareness of the X-Men, before, again, long before I was an editor, I suppose it's not too crazy for me to say that I am a straight white cis man. So,
Okay, this podcast is over. Okay, thank you. Thank you, Jordan White. Thanks.
Which is just to say, there are things about the X-Men that I didn't appreciate as a young person that I have learned are much more important about them. But I think the thing that always resonated with me was the real deep family connection that the X-Men shares, that they grow for themselves, amongst each other, in a way that I never felt with the Avengers, who seem much more like friends from work, to quote a film. And things like that. They're people who, of course they care about each other, and in the way that I care about my friends at work, very much so. But the X-Men really was a family. And like that found family, that chosen family, who are like, yes, I come from somewhere and I have a family, but now we have this deep, true friendship and love that comes with this kind of deep connection. So that was the first thing that really resonated with me. And that, by the way, is a thing that Excalibur and X-Men absolutely share deeply. That part of it, the lighthearted tone of Excalibur isn't always present in X-Men, but that deep love of their friendship is always there. But as I grew to think about them more deeply, and again, move into the Grant Morrison era and appreciate them as an older person, a lot of that came into it, that you can see how they, I apologize, they really, the approach that they took, saying let's make them into a significant subculture, like let's give them a culture, let's give them,
Yeah.
I thought it was such a great approach and so real, and it made them feel more of the world around us. Like, Marvel very famously talks about being the world outside your window. This made the mutants feel much more like the world outside my window, as a reader, than they ever had before. Which is why speaking of things I was not a huge fan of in X history, I was really bummed when they did No More Mutants and said there was only less than 300 of them, because the argument that people made at Marvel, and again, people can disagree, I'm not calling them like fools or anything, but the argument that I always heard people make was there was too many mutants, that people were using it as too much of a crutch, that they didn't want to do this and that. I was always like, then just tell them to stop doing that. Because when you reduce mutants to less than 300 people on Earth, they're not a minority. They're a statistical zero. That would be like, I feel bigoted against Native Americans named Steve. That's
Yeah,
it, though.
you're a rounding error in a census.
It's not, they're not significant enough to be hated and feared. I mean, yes, they are still powerful and whatnot, so that changes the matter a little bit. But in Grant's run, they felt like you can understand. I don't want to say you can understand why people hated them. That's a terrible thing to say. It makes it sound like I hated them. But you can understand that way that people felt threatened by them, because they are significant. Because they made them into the future. They made them into an inevitability, right? In the way that, like now, well, I say now, I guess it's been many years, but there are news stories about, like, in such and such number of years, white people in America will become a minority because of such and such thing. And like that sparks this like really unpleasant fear in people that results in all sorts of awful things. Well, that's the awful kinds of stuff that the X-Men has been dealing with, and it I don't know, it felt more real and more significant in that run, and that really absolutely drew me in.
Yeah, I think there's a reality of, trying to, when you vilify a group of people that, in order to make a scapegoat, there actually has to be a scapegoat there. Not that they're justified in their beliefs, but, when it's enough people to be a high school, you don't feel as threatened by it in a practical sense. So, editors don't usually get the recognition they deserve, especially on a family of titles that are part of a shared universe. But did any editors or editors in chief even influence how you approach your work? Or did you like when did you become aware that like editors exist and that they are actually doing something in your comic consumption history? Because I've only been reading comics for, 7 years. And so it wasn't even until like 4 years ago that I recognized, oh wait, no, there's a whole operation here outside of just the actual individual creator of a comic.
I mean, I think like most comic readers, I didn't really understand what editors were until I was doing, no, I don't want to say till I was doing the job, because probably a little bit before that, but until close to that. I mean, I was aware of the names of some editors because I read so many comics, and especially I was born in 1979, the very end of the year. So during the 80s is when I started picking up. Like, I don't remember a time when I wasn't reading comics, so I was reading comics the whole time. But back then, they would do like the bullpen bulletins sometimes, or like other sometimes editors would have little columns in the back of the letters pages, like I can't remember, like I can't remember any of the names of the columns now, but like I remember Jim Salicrup had one, and like all sorts of people did, right? And so I would see them there, but I didn't really understand what that meant. Like, I knew they were making the comics, and they were probably making jokes about how they were yelling at freelancers for being late. And I was like, okay, so like they're like their boss or something. It probably wasn't until, not when I was literally working at the company, but before I was at the company, I was doing like radio serials, and I think making those is probably when I kind of understood, oh, I see, like they're like a producer, and they're making sure everything runs smoothly and making sure that it's high quality and like working with everybody at every step of the way, because that's what I was doing on my radio shows. And I was like, oh, okay, yeah, I get this. It's they're not the writer, but they are important in move making the story happen in a slightly different way, and here's how that works. And it sounded like something I was interested in doing. I can't say that I knew any of the editors before that well enough to be like, I want to be just like that editor, because I just didn't. And I think that's, I mean, in a way, that's by design, in the sense that, even to this day, Nick Lowe, right, like will put do letters pages and stuff where he tries to show off his personality and have fun, right? And kind of go, oh, check out all this stuff. I haven't usually been as into doing that in the letters pages, but for the most part, there's a saying that Tom Brevoort likes to say, which is the creators get the credit and the editors get the blame. And that's because, yeah, we're not there to, it's not just that we're not there to be like, hey, check out how awesome my books are. Of course, I want everybody to think my books are awesome. But even if you do think my books are awesome, you're probably not going to go, they're awesome because of Jordan. They're awesome because of the people I hired and how great they are, for sure. And hopefully I don't get in their way. And hopefully I can help them be the best version of them they can. But then if a book really sucks, that's when people are likely to go, this guy made a terrible book. And you know what? They're right about that too, because again, it's my job to hire the people, even if I hired somebody who did a bad job, and it's my job to help the person do the best job they can. So at every level of that, if a book is bad, it is my fault, at least on some level. And to some extent, you go, yeah, but shouldn't you then get some of the credit? Yeah, but that's just not how it works. Nobody goes, who's responsible for this thing I like? They go, who's responsible for the thing I don't? That's how it is. It's fine. It's fine. So that's, to some extent, I think that whole system of how that all works is part of why I didn't really know who the editors were ahead of time. I've met a lot of great people, and I've learned a lot of great people from all of my bosses along the way, though. Both Mark Panicha, who was my first editor, and Nick Lowe, who was my second, taught me so many different things. So I'm really thankful to them both.
So let's get into this a little bit with Krakoa specifically. Over the last almost 5 years now, I think Hawksbox came out in summer of 2019, but you were editor of the X books starting in 17, 2018. Is that right around when you took them over?
Yeah, I took them over just before the end of the Blue and Gold, the later Blue and Gold era. I didn't edit either of those books, but I th we had Darren Shan finish them out while I started working on the relaunch after that. But yeah, that was right around the era. I did finish out the last bunch of issues of X-Men Red in that era, the Jean team.
The Tom Taylor book. Yeah. So,
And I took over with a Return of Wolverine, which was already like far into planning when I came in, but I was there to for the execution of it.
can you talk a little bit about, I guess, how you approach Jonathan Hickman, or how Hickman was approached, or maybe he came to you? What's that kind of that like that secret origin of like the chocolate and the peanut butter kind of coming together
Well,
to
that's
create
interesting.
this?
I wish I could take any credit for this. I can't. None whatsoever. Jonathan was already a huge deal by this point, obviously, because he had done Secret Wars, which was the most successful event in a gazillion years, right? And had already had a bunch of movie characters like taken from his books and put into movies, and secret plans for all these this thing and that thing. And he had pitched a very rough and very different, and I wish I remembered all the details of how it was different, but a very rough and different version of what would become House of X and Powers of 10 a few years earlier, at a summit. I think it was right, I don't remember the exact dates, but it was right around the time that Mike Martz left Marvel, and Mark Panicia was taking over the X-Men. It was right around there. It wasn't like this is the next thing, but he was beginning to cook this thing that he was like, at some point I want to do this. And I don't remember why, because again, I wasn't involved in X-Men at all at the time. But they were like, just pitch it now, just pitch it now, and we'll talk about it. And it was there. So it was already kind of in the works. Now, that was years earlier, and it changed a bunch since then. And when I came onto X-Men, I didn't, by the way, I didn't know Jonathan. Like, I had met him at a Marvel summit or two, but I'd never worked with him. I never had like a long or serious conversation with him. So when I came on to X-Men, when CB asked me, do you want to be the X-Men editor? We were talking about, okay, so this is going to wrap up, and you could do a relaunch at this point. And then from what I understand, CB said, Jonathan is probably going to come in, and he's going to do like a big X-Men miniseries. And we were like, oh, okay. Like, what is it? And he was like, I don't really know yet what it is, but it's going to be like this big mini series. So I went into the beginning of my X-Men planning thinking John's just going to come in, do a thing, and then he'll be done, and that will be it.
A quick 6 issues and he's out.
Like, he'll just come in, do this big thing. And we were like, okay, cool. And then when the first and also it was very unclear. And I'm super not going to get into any details on this, but like, there's a business side to all this too. So there are negotiations and contracts and all these things. So it was all like, probably that's going to happen. Like, very likely that's going to happen. But we don't have any details yet, and we don't know because none of that stuff was settled. And it was like, okay, so what are we going to do? Well, here's where we are. We were, and let's do this and this and this, and then figure it out. So when we started the run that was X-Men disassembled, and then went into Matt Rosenberg's run, we knew there's a good chance that this is going to be a temporary thing. This is not going to be like a forever gig. This is going to be a thing, and then Jonathan's going to do his thing, and then we're going to relaunch the books. But I didn't know how much fundamentally that would change what the X-Men was. I literally was starting plans for like, all right, so John's going to do this thing, whatever that's going to be, and then we'll come back and we'll do a whole new relaunch, and it'll be, I had thoughts on like, here's how we'll do the relaunch. Here's the ways that we'll do something different than what has been done for the last like 5 years in order to make it feel fresh and new. And then he did his pitch and it was like, oh, this is not a quick story. This is not like, I don't know. I think in my head we were thinking like, I don't know, like Bendis Secret War, right? Like it'll be a big story, but like then you go back to just doing comics. Like it's fine. Like it was a big story and then you're done. And that was not at all what he was pitching. And also by the time he pitched it, then it became clear. No, this isn't just a pitch. This is a pitch for him to come on, do this, and then direct the line in a different direction entirely that will be governed, like not governed, but like pointed by this series. And as soon as that happened, all of my plans went into the garbage can, which was fine. And it was like, okay, again, this is an exciting reinvention. And I've said before, it took me a minute to get on board. When he first pitched it, I was like, I don't know about this. Like, this is a fundamental shift. This is a huge shift. And I mean, I'll admit that my instincts on X-Men, it's weird to say this. It's weird to say this because of how on board with Krakoa I got and like am to this day. But my very first knee-jerk reaction to Krakoa was probably kind of similar to some of the ones of the people who don't like the Krakoan era, going, I thought these guys were superheroes. Why aren't they acting like superheroes? Like, why aren't they saving kittens from trees? That's not a thing X-Men do, but you know what I mean. Like, why aren't they doing good in the world? Isn't that what superhero comics are fundamentally about? But the more I thought about it and the more on board I got with it, like the more on board I got with it in that way that Grant's books went, this isn't just a superhero book. There's more to this. There's more going on here. And Jonathan's approach, I think, yeah, the biggest shift it did was by slipping books that weren't superhero books in under the guise of being superhero books. They are books about science fiction, but also about like nation building and asking like hard questions about what does that mean? Like, what is it to be a nation build? Bringing up questions that are too complicated for simple good and evil. A lot of the criticism, pardon me, a lot of times criticism of the Krakoan era does. I don't want to say it's simplified, it's that simple, because lots of people have lots of reasons they don't want to like something. That's fine. But you will hear a lot of things about like they are bad now, or they are evil now, or Krakoa is evil. That's the easiest thing. Krakoa is an evil nation. And I'm always like, is the United States an evil nation? Because the United States has done terrible things, and there have been terrible people involved in running the United States. But ideally, as a whole, we overcome that and are not an evil nation. And I feel like Krakoa is very similar. There have been awful things that have been done. There are awful people who have been involved. And the good people are trying their best to make it better. And it's such a complicated story. Does that taint who the X-Men are? That's a question for every reader to decide.
I think that gets into an interesting area. The Krakoan era for me, not having read as many, is just I love it so much because it creates a texture to the geopolitics of superheroism. It kind of gets at that same criticism that people have for like Batman. Hey, you're a billionaire and you really want to help people. Maybe don't dress as a flying mammal and attack the city. Like, oh, okay, these mutants, they have powers. Could they use them to create medicine that would cure diseases? Can they prolong the life of everyone on Earth? And in return, all we have to do is respect their geopolitical sovereignty and allow them to have like this weird ethno state. And I think it gets into this very moral gray area. But it also pushes the kind of the stories that you can tell about who your superheroes are and the way that they use the power that they have.
See, now that's a really fascinating example, and I think really apt, but it also illustrates why I one of the reasons why I should say that I will say a million times over that Jonathan Hickman is really a genius is that he is able to write it in a way that still has so much, well, in my opinion, awesome X-Men-ness in it. Because if someone came along, if an amazing writer came along and said, "I'm taking over Batman, and you know what? That's what it's about. He's not going to dress as Batman anymore. He's going to make real change in Gotham." I kind of think Batman fans would be justified in going, "This guy sucks. Why is this person writing this?"
What do you mean he's funding a soup kitchen and every issue is about him volunteering at the kitchen?
I mean, and you can say, "Yeah, but look at Joker's doing all this." And yeah, but there's no Batman in this comic anymore. And I think to some extent, some people have said that. I don't think they're right. I think that one, I mean, and again, I'm not gonna like read to you from Jonathan's pitch, but like Jonathan's pitch wasn't just a plot document. It was philosophical and talking about what makes X-Men fundamentally X-Men. And his answer to what makes X-Men fundamentally X-Men was not the same answer that every writer gives. It's not the again, I won't go into all of it, but it's not the thing that first comes to your mind. He kind of goes, "Yes, but really it's this, and here's why." And he stayed really true to that in a way that worked really well. And again, to my mind, absolutely reads as X-Men for every single page of it.
Did he, when he brought in the pitch, the Bible, the reimagining of it, was Moira always there, kind of at the center of it all, bringing her back, having her power of resurrection, reincarnation,
Oh yeah.
not resurrection, reincarnation, but and then just like this is now, for v using video game terms, this is now her 10th time going at it, and the first 9 times didn't work, and so she was going to try a different approach. Was that always part
Absolutely.
of it? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I say, well, okay, it depends what you mean by out always. I don't believe that was in the years earlier version of it that he pitched. But again, I don't remember that version quite as well. But as soon as this time, when he handed in his document, I say it wasn't just a plot outline because there was lots of other stuff, but it also was a plot outline. Like it had the story of Hox and Pox in it. And it did have that issue two reveal of here's what's really going on with Moira and always has been. And it was absolutely awesome. And such a cool concept, such a cool concept, well thought out. Here's something totally irrelevant. I was looking at. Why was I looking at an old that issue? Maybe it was when I was doing the chronological reordering of Hox Pox that we put up recently. The panel that gets me every time is the panel at the start of her second life, where she is just like talking about why she doesn't get together with her husband again, because she has a husband and kids and a happy life the first time. As a person with a wife and a child and a happy life, I'm like, well, of course I would. How would I not? And the fact that she's like, no, that doesn't work because, like, what does she say? Something like knowing all the ways that they won't change. It's so depressing. It's just this
Yeah.
heartbreaking gut punch of a moment to me every single time I read it. I'm like, no, poor Moira.
You can't predict everything that someone will do exactly, but you're gonna know the broad brushstrokes enough to be annoyed a second lifetime of it.
And the mystery's gone, right? Like the excitement of like finding somebody and creating a life with them. It's like, well, I've done this. I created a life with them. Now it's time for something new. It is, it's really, it is gut-wrenching. You're absolutely right.
Such a bummer. Poor Moira. It's all under everything she's done since then is understandable as a result. I'm
Including
kidding.
ripping
I'm
off
kidding.
Banshee's face, yeah.
So s since 1963, the major theme of the X-Men, kind of broad brushstroke, has been fighting for a world that hates and fears them.
Yeah.
How would you say that theme has been augmented over the last 5 years?
Well, you know, it turned it on, not turned it on its head, but like turned around the way that we looked at it. Because that's obviously still the case. Like, it's not like the world started liking mutants because of what happened. In fact, in some ways, they like them less, but in other ways, they like them more. One of the things I found really fascinating, and this is going to be painting with some broad strokes. So if anybody is listening to this and they're like, that's not true, I'm sorry. But one of the things I found was there is a divide between people who are like, it's awful that they did this, that they founded their own nation. It's awful that they founded their own nation and said, this is a place for us. The criticisms I've seen, not 100%, but the vast majority of them are from people who share my demographics, from straight white cis men, or well, maybe women as well, but straight white cis people and people of color, people who are LGBT. That's where I see people going, no, this is absolutely understandable and I get it. I get it. And this is a place for them and that's good. That's really fascinating to me. And I think, again, it's another one of those complicated questions because people will say, but isn't it better if everyone isn't part of what they've been saying all along? We're all the same. Yes. Yes, it is. But what they've been getting back in return is no, we're not. And as Cyclops said, like, did you think we were just going to take it? Is it wrong of them to say, okay, then we're going to stop fighting that hard for you to treat us decently and just start living d decently ourselves?
Yeah, and they decided to take up every part of the LGBTQ plus agenda, which was colonizing Mars.
It took him a while to get there, but
Yeah.
yes. Yeah, I mean the idea that the, I mean and the fact that they don't do it, that like you mentioned, they do it by being helpful. They do it by going, by the way, we're still saving you. We're still helping you. Here's medicine that will advance your life. Here's medicine that will stop you from help with dementia and things like that. We will go forth and we will improve the world for you. You will be better off because we are doing what we're doing. But also, we're going to go do our thing now. And like, we're not going to ask for your permission. And I think that's. It came at an important time, I think, because it's, I mean, it's a really, listen, it's a really divisive time in history. I can only speak as a person who is as old as I am, right? But to me, it feels like there's never been a time when the sides of every issue had to be as clearly drawn as possible, and there is no quarter given. You cannot like the people on the other side of any issue in any way, right? And as a result, the idea that Xavier has been arguing for since the 60s of, well, some people would describe it as assimilation, right? People are really questioning that. Is that really what we want? Is that equality? Is that fair that is what is asked of us? And again, I don't have any good answers. Like, I don't know. And I think nobody knows that people have there are lots of opinions, but nobody knows what the right answer is. And this era said, let's look at it a different way and see. Let's see what happens here. And I think, again, at the very least, I think it's valuable because it is providing a means of looking at and talking about these issues in through a lens of fiction that is important. I mean, that's what it's always been. That's the use of the mutant metaphor the whole time for the civil rights movement through I think it was it the film that really turned the corner into it being much more LGBTQ focused in some people, well, for a lot of people anyway. I mean, it was a little bit before that as well, but I feel like that was the biggest moment. It's been that the whole time. We're just looking at a different aspect of it, and again, I wish I could say, and we have the right answer, and we're going to tell it to you at the end, but we don't because no one
Well,
does.
it would be disappointing, I think. It would be less satisfying as a story because it's not the same as kind of like a plot where you have a final end point and then you leave it up for the audiences to interpret. This is, to me, a more thematic thing of, okay, so you believe you could secede from all the nations of the world. Supposing we got over like right or wrong, whether or not you should do it, Here's you've got all your work ahead of you. There's 1,000 practical issues you're going to run into. And so you need to have thought about how you would tackle developing a justice system, figuring out a way of ordering your society. How are you going to handle huge, deep complications in the nature of your operation and how you engage with others and how you compromise with people who you've previously hated? That there's just a lot there that you're going to have to work through before you can just say, yeah, I want to break off from the rest of you guys because I don't like you right now.
Well, and or you won't figure those things out, and then you have to deal with that fact as well. Like they did it. They made Krakoa happen at all costs, and they stepped in a lot of landmines that are kind of some of them slower moving landmines, but they absolutely were there, and they had to deal with that. I mean, one of the things we had to deal with at the beginning of the Krakoan age, right, was we would get a lot of pitches in from people who wanted to join us as a writer, right? We would get talk to people and go, hey, well, what are you thinking about? And the most common thing, and it's understandable why, I'm not criticizing them, but the most common thing that they would pitch for us to us looking at what we had were currently doing was, well, actually, did you know there is actually a downside to Krakoa. There's actually some problems here. And we would have to say to them, yes, actually, we are well aware of that fact. And we are actually deliberately not doing books about the problem of Krakoa right now. We are starting the run by talking about how great Krakoa is and what does work, because it's not like there's nothing that works. There's a lot of good going on here too. Let's focus on that, and let's let the problems kind of sit under the surface, or possibly even to fester until they can come out and be a much bigger problem. I mean, you look at Immortal X-Men. Immortal X-Men is just Kieran tackling headfirst so many of those problems one after another, and they're bad. They're all pretty bad. But we wanted to wait. We wanted to allow those problems to become bigger problems, and also to allow what is good about Krakoa to become a bigger good, to raise the stakes on both sides. To go, if you start by going, we've started Krakoa, and guess what? There's a lot of problems. Then it doesn't. I think it feels like, okay, well then probably don't do it. Right? Hey, here's this thing, and here's all the wrong things you're going to have to do to get there. Well, it's like, okay, well then maybe we shouldn't do this. Let's lean into what's good about it. Let's lean into what makes it work and why it's valuable. And then when the problems come up, it'll be, we don't want to destroy this good thing because there are problems under it. I mean, again, going back to talking about the United States for a minute, like when we hear about awful things that happened in the country's past, we don't go, yeah, scrap it. Like, scrap it. Like,
Yeah.
well, look at all this awful stuff we had to do to get to where we are today. 100%, those are bad. Ideally, we go, let's stop doing the bad things now if we haven't already. And then we can look to trying to make good on what we've done in the past. Sometimes we don't even do that. Ideally, we should. Anyway, we don't just go throw it in.
Or it could be a situation where, like, let's not even look at the problems of the past. I mean, there's clearly, like, governors out there, presidential candidate out there who's basically said, no, we're not going to talk about all the bad stuff that America did. America's always been a great country. It's always will be a great country. But to your great point, it's like, yeah, it's an ideal, it's a value, but we've done some nasty shit over, the last 250 years as a country. That's what nation building is. And every nation's had to do that. But you mentioned Immortal, and I wanted to talk about this a little bit because we love Immortal X-Men. We love X-Men Red. Those were two of our favorites, kind of in the once Jonathan decided to leave, the X-Books. But he started something, and then a couple of years in, he decided to leave. Some of the stories we saw was because it got so popular that, Marvel wanted to keep it around. I don't know how if that's true or not, but
That's
how
not
did you?
quite the way I would say it
Okay.
happened. I think Jonathan has talked
So you're
about this
saying
a
he was
bit.
fired in disgrace?
No, opposite of all of that stuff. No, Jonathan is a really great writer and a really great mentor for people. And working with him on the X-Books was so incredible for him, for me, for every other writer who was involved in them working on them. I think it wasn't at all what he was expecting it to be. By which I mean, he knows what writing is. You know, I'm not saying he doesn't know how it would go, his story. He knew how his story would go. But I think the role as quote unquote head of X, as the kind of, you know, godfather of all the X books, was a very different role than he was expecting it to be. Because he didn't want to steamroll everyone. He didn't want to come in and go, listen, guys, do what you're going to do, but don't get in my way. I've got a story and I'm going to do it. So if you say you're going to use Doug Ramsey, you better not use him like this, because here's where he's going to be 3 years from now, and you better not contradict that. That's not, he had no interest in doing that. He came in with a story mapped out. But as soon as we brought in other writers and started collaborating, he became incredibly generous with them, and he wanted them to be able to tell the stories they wanted to tell. And he wanted to give them the freedom to do whatever they wanted to do. I don't mean whatever they wanted to do, but you know what I'm saying. Like, in the same way that any writer at Marvel gets to do whatever they want to do, it's a collaborative medium. We are talking together. But he didn't want to dictate. And that combined with a few other things. I mean, again, I don't want to talk about the story that didn't happen in detail. I don't want to go, well, what he was going to do was blah, 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 because that's still his story. And who knows? Maybe he'll do something with it at some other point or whatnot. But what I will say is there were aspects of the story he wanted to tell that he and I, but most importantly, he began to doubt were a good idea to do for, again, reasons. And so he started to question, is this something we should do or is it not? And yes, as we have said publicly, as he has said publicly, for sure, the original plan was a much more clear-cut three-act story. In act one, act one is focused on the building of Krakoa and whatnot. Act two is this next bit that is not been revealed, and the act three was this third bit that was not revealed. And basically he went to the writers and we all got together in one of our big X meetings. This was still in COVID time, so we were all Zooming every week into a giant meeting and talking about the direction of the line. Like, that's how we planned Ten of Swords very closely together, you know, in these weekly, well, I say Zoom meetings. I think at the beginning of the pandemic, they were BlueJeans meetings, but eventually they were Zoom meetings. And he said, like, I don't know that we should do the thing that I was going to originally do. Do you guys think I should barrel ahead and we should do it and we should start wrapping up Act One and move forward? Or do you want to stick around in Act One and play some more? And I do think that when he asked everybody that, they didn't think he meant, and I will leave. I think he was just, they just were taking it as, do you feel like there's more story to tell of what's happening on Krakoa? And I think everybody went, yeah, I think there is. I'd love to stay here. And even for me, I didn't know he was saying that. And I kind of didn't want him to leave. When he started talking to me about, yeah, I think I'm going to have to leave then, because like I'll wrap up this, and this, and then I'll let like you guys, you know, run with it. I was like, well, hang on. Just because you're not going to do X big thing that we don't think is a good idea anymore, it doesn't mean you can't still tell the story. You just have to change that part, which admittedly is a big piece of it, but there's still other pieces of what you wanted to do that are great, and you could hit those and come up with a new part. And he was like, yeah, no, it's probably fine. Like, you guys just keep doing Krakoa then, and I'll move along. And we were like, okay, all right, well, I guess that's what we're gonna do. And that came to pass. That's a very casual version of it, where we just are going, all right, sure, whatever.
Well, so you've mentioned, parts of Jonathan Hickman's story that you don't want to reveal. Maybe they might be able to come back in some way. But you also said that before Jonathan Hickman came along, you guys had a few ideas about what you wanted
Sure.
to do. Are any of those ones you'd be willing to share?
Yeah, sure. Why not? I mean, listen, they're not going to be earth-shattering because, pardon me, because, well, I'm not a writer. And this was me kind of going, here's the direction I think the line should go. Like, here's what I don't think works about the current era, and here's what I do. And it is kind of funny how different they are from what we ended up doing, what Jonathan did, because basically the biggest one was, let's decentralize the X-Men. The X-Men have been living in the same building. And I don't mean the X-Men. Sorry, I don't even mean the X-Men. I mean all of the mutant species has been living in like one or two buildings for the last like 10 years. They have been so centralized that every mutant is a guest, is a not even a guest, like a background character in every other book. I want to put a definite stop to that. And so my hope at that time was to split them up into teams again that had very distinct mission statements and locations all around the world. And to some extent, other than the all around the world part, I did stick with that. Like, when we started the Krakoan era, I was like, I want these teams to all have different mission statements. They all live on Krakoa because that's what we're doing right now. But they all are doing something different. I don't want it to be, it's the X-Men and the other X-Men and the other X-Men who all are just doing X-Men thing. So that was the biggest one. And aside from that, I think, so it's been a while. It was a very dark time of the X-Men, as you can recall, where they were like really going through stuff. So I think what I really wanted to pitch to whatever writer I was going, whatever writer and writers I was going to bring in, was the idea that at the end of, yeah, you know what? Now that I think about it, this was bef it was before the end of Disassembled, but it was also before we found out that Jonathan was coming on, and the scope of what Jonathan was going to try to do before Rosenberg's run started. So at the time we were thinking, okay, so Disassembled is going to be the end of something. And so at that moment, Disassembled was going to end with the X-Men, guess what? Disassembling, and the X-Men were going to break up. And we were thinking, and then we'll figure out some way to do something where I was pitching at one point like a 3 month gap where we all just did only solo books for 3 months to focus on like important characters, and then after that 3 months, like they started to congeal again, and somebody starts up a new team called the X-Men, and it would be like this character, and they it's here, and again, but somebody else starts up a new X Factor, and somebody else starts up a new Excalibur, and somebody else starts up a new X Force, and all of that stuff happens in different places for different reasons. That was the but again, that's not a there were no writers involved. There was no
Yeah.
writer hired yet. If I had if we if Jonathan hadn't been coming in, the next step would have been me going to writers and going, hey, like this writer, I want to write the main X-Men book. What are you interested in doing? Here's what I'm thinking. And I'd give him like a document probably where I wrote up those ideas and say, what do you think of that? And if they said, I think that's garbage, then I would have been like, oh, well, what do you think? And they would do it. I don't want to be prescriptive as an editor. I'm happy to come in with ideas and go, let's talk about this. What do you think of something like this? And there are plenty of times when the writer's like, yes, I love that. And this. But there are other times when they go, yeah, that's not like what I'm looking for. Like, but what do you think of this? And I go, great, let's talk about that.
Yeah.
So that's where I was. But like I said, it was early enough on in that planning process that there were no writers involved. It was just me going, here's what I think we should do. And then we found out about Jonathan, and that's when we went, oh, okay, we're going to need this much time before that to get that ready, Jonathan's run. And that's when we hired Matt to continue, and simultaneously, I think, came up with what are we going to do with the rest of the stuff? And we came up with Age of X-Man.
Sadly, the Krakoa era is going to end very soon, as we said at the start of this conversation. Tom Brevoort's going to be taking over. I'm curious about that kind of that transition period. Is like, what does that look like? Is it orderly, like normal presidential transitions, not counting one from three years ago, but what does that look like when you go from something, that's so big and monumental, and then it's going to another big and monumental thing, but it's looking pretty different than what has been happening the last few years.
Well, it's about as orderly a transition as you could have. It's a very different transition editorial. So now here's the thing. Like, most of the time when editors change, nobody cares. Everybody made a big deal out of it when Tom started talking about it. Partially because his first cryptic post about it, where he didn't say what it was, started so much wild speculation that it was like, all right, we need to talk about what this actually is. Most of the time, nobody cares at all when editors change books. Because, well, a lot of times it's done kind of unceremoniously. So, like I mentioned, when I came onto the X-Men books, it was not at a clean breaking point. It was, hey, we're going to switch you over to X-Men. We're going to switch Mark Panisha over to the Star Wars books, which I was doing at the time. And we're going to switch like this book here, and this book is going here. And we're going to do that as soon as humanly possible, which usually means like in 2 weeks. Like, it's like this needs to happen, right? Like, we're going to do this now. And which is why, like I said, I've either finished out or oversaw the finishing out of a bunch of the previous ones run. In this case, I'm really, really thankful that I am getting to finish out the Krakoan era. I don't know. I'm not actually sure whose call that was, whether that was CB or whether that was Tom. But the fact that they were like, let's have Jordan finish this. He's been living this for 5 years. He knows this stuff. He knows what is going on in every issue, and he knows he's worked with all the creators so closely and all these things. Let's let him finish that out, and then we'll have Tom start already working on the relaunch. It'll be ready to start running. And as a result, yeah, it's still happening. I don't send my last issue of X-Men until sometime in April. Although, is that true? Yeah, I think late April. It's not too long now. I think it's less than a month. Oh my God, that's crazy. That's crazy. Maybe it's just about a month. Yeah, it's just about a month. Wow.
How does that feel? I mean, number one, knowing that, you're like it's like a TV show that gets to know that it's we're in our last season kind of thing, but also you've been working for a long time in this particular group of superheroes. It's kind of closing a major chapter for a lot of fans. What's that like for you, kind of emotionally?
It's really complicated and heavy. It really is, because, like you said, it's a story I've cared about so deeply for so long, and I really hope that it lands well, the ending. I'm really, really happy right now with where X-Men 35, aka Uncanny X-Men 700, is, and what it's going to be. I'm really, really happy with that, and I hope so much that I'm right about it, and that it will land well with fans, and that they will feel like it is a satisfying ending to the era. I hope so. In addition, and this is the not public side of it, by which I mean the part the public doesn't see as much. Much like a TV show ending, like, I do feel like I am losing my family too, in the sense of the X Office really became a very close-knit group for a while there. And a big piece of that, I mean, I'm not gonna lie, a big piece of that was that COVID happened. We were working closely together already before COVID happened, but then COVID struck, and the X Slack that all the writers and editors were on really was a lifeline. We were on there every day. We were doing the work as always, but we were also talking about the world and how insane everything was, and our fears, and what I mean, if you I don't know if you remember that time in the industry, books stopped shipping. We didn't stop working on books, but books stopped shipping, and like everything was so crazy and intense. And that's when we went, okay, the world is falling apart. Let's do a whatever it was, 26-part crossover. How about that? And we, you know.
Some people just made sourdough bread, Jordan. You could have cut yourself some slack, I think.
It was a beautiful thing, and it kept us sane. The whole of the ex-slack kept us sane, and it was a big part of my life. And to have that ending for real, I mean, over time it has slowly ended, in the sense that so many of the people that made it what it was at that time have already bowed out. You know, Jonathan first, and then, you know, Vita, Teeny, Leah. You know, but some new people came in, you know, both from Kieran and Al, but also more recently, Steve Orlando, Steve Fox, who are both so terrific on there. But yeah, the fact that it's going to be completely over soon is also a really, really big and sad thing that I'm going to miss desperately, desperately.
We will too. And, you know, you mentioned COVID. We've been doing this podcast for 7 years. We're all friends. We're all based in DC. We usually record in person. We do, you know, conversations like this over Zoom, but we had to move to Zoom, you know, to protect ourselves. And when Ten of Swords was coming out, you know, we had this idea, because we started becoming friends with other X-Men podcasts, and we created a crossover podcast thing talking about every chapter.
That's
So it
great.
was like, you know, the House of X podcast folks, the X Reads folks, you know, a number of others. And like every week we'd have a different guest on, and we talked about the chapters that came out that week. So it was a lot of fun. But this is kind of leading into my next question, kind of getting more into just sort of interactions with fans, and with, you know, the rise of social media, especially over the last 15 years, X Twitter being a very big thing, which is kind of funny now that Twitter has turned into X. I always kind of like laugh about that whenever I think about
Oh,
it.
because now it's XX.
Now it's XX, right? Yeah. Pretty soon it'll be triple X, and it's just gonna be porn. But what
Yes,
is
soon.
your experience with, you know, kind of dealing with fandom, both good and bad? Because something we try to strive to be is, you know, be responsible fans. We love this stuff, but we also see the toxicity out there. You know, what's your interaction? And then kind of as a follow-up, like, what makes X fans kind of different from other fans, like Star Wars fans? I mean, you worked on the Star Wars books for a while, Star Trek fans, Batman fans, you know, any other major fandom?
Yeah, it's funny. I got out of Star Wars. I stopped editing Star Wars right before The Last Jedi came out. So I only had wonderful experiences with Star Wars fans. Everything was copacetic in Star Wars land when I was working on Star Wars books. They only started trying to murder each other after I left. So there you are. What I would say about X-Men fans are extremely passionate, and I think, in my experience, the reason that they are one of the reasons I think that they are it's so personal for X-Fans is two things that are both connected to personal identity. That first of all, there is the fact that, like we talked about, the X-Men does speak to the metaphor, right, of the outsider and the person who is a minority or oppressed in some way. So there's that piece of it. But then also, they're also an extremely diverse group of mutants, right? Especially if you factor in like all the extended teams over the years, there's so many different people that represent every kind of person in the world, ideally, right? And as a result, I feel like X-Men fans take the characters personally in a way that not all fans do. Listen, all fans do. I get it. They really do. Peter Parker fans are extremely passionate about Peter Parker. I'm a Peter Parker fan. Thankfully, I'm not as passionate as
I'm
some of them are.
sorry, just for people who don't know, who is Peter Parker?
Sorry. Spider hyphen man. If you Google that, you'll find him. But yes, I feel like it gets to a personal place inside of X fans, really, really deeply, and they are passionate in the good and the bad ways as a result of it. I have had great times talking with X fans. It's why I come on podcasts like this, because I love talking about comics, but I love talking about X-Men, and I love talking about what people love about X-Men and what I love about X-Men. It's so much fun. That said, there is a dark side, as you said, and people can get real mean about it because they have that connection to those characters. You mentioned Twitter. I used to be on Twitter. Technically, my account is still there. When I started on X-Men, I was doing X-Men Monday on Twitter, just posting things on Twitter, and I would frequently be like, "Oh, I'm on a train riding home. Let's do a Q&A. Like, just ask me questions." And I would just answer people's questions. And people, most people were really cool about it, but some people, I'm just a dude, man. You know what I mean? I'm just a dude answering questions, like going like, "Hey, what do you think about this character?" And I'll just tell you because it's just my opinion. It doesn't make a difference. But because I am who I am, then people would take it really personally and be like, "Well, they hate this character now, or he hates this character, or he's going to ruin this character because he said this thing about them. This is his opinion on him." I think most of the time, I mean, people could say I ruined whatever character they want to say I ruined, but a lot of those places, their fears were mislaid. Like, for example, early in my time on X-Men, people would ask about Magneto, and I'd say, "I think Magneto works best as a villain. He's like an antagonist. Like he's shown that like he does. This is his true colors, and he doesn't he's better as a person who fights against the X-Men because he represents saying mutants are better than humans are." And the X-Men go, "No, they're not. They're both good, right?" But I don't, like I said, I don't want to be a dictator of stories either. I don't go to my writers and go, "Guys, I think your Magneto is not dicky enough and like not evil enough." Like, Jonathan came in, and the kind of stories he wants to tell with Magneto are not that kind of story. He had a different take on him. And even more, Al Ewing had an extremely well-rounded take on Magneto, where he goes yes to all of the good and bad that he's ever done on panel, and let's bring it all together into one cohesive human being. And I, again, as an editor, I want to facilitate the writers telling their best story, the artists drawing their best story, not tell them, "Here's the kind of story you have to do." Anyway, that was a kind of a digression from saying people get really passionate. I'm not on Twitter anymore, and I'm sad to say it's because I'm overly sensitive, and I would go on and talk about X-Men, and again, not everyone, not even most people, but some people would get real prickly about it, and it made me not want to be on there anymore, and I had to leave. So.
It's pretty amazing to see, because I think that, if you're not used to reading comics, you're used to consuming bingeable TV or movies on demand, whatever, your entire story is pretty packaged nicely. But comics, if you're reading them, they come out every week, every other week, every month. And it's funny to see people online who get very upset because they're like, "I can't believe they're doing that to this character. Haven't they forgot all this stuff?" And then the next issue is about addressing how the stuff they did in the last issue relates to that character's history.
Yeah. And here's the thing. That's also what we want, right? We want people to care so much about our books that they literally cannot wait to get the next one. That the fact that the next one isn't here is upsetting to them, so that when it comes out, they will buy it and read it immediately. Obviously, that's what we want. But it's a double-edged sword. And yeah, that then sometimes people are gonna and listen. I'm not saying I'm right, because like I said, I'm kind of a wuss about it. Like I'm too sensitive. I shouldn't care so much about what some people say, but I just found myself obsessing over it and being unhappy about it when I didn't want to be. So I was like, this isn't healthy for me anymore. And I just left.
It's understandable because, I mean, look, at the end of the day, it's human beings creating this stuff, and it's entertainment, it's comics. I love it. I've been reading comics most of my life, just like you, Jordan. I can't remember when I wasn't reading comics, but like it is it's a real person who's creating this. And even if I don't care for the direction or I don't like the interpretation, I'll just wait till the next one. I don't need to shit on somebody online. So I get it. And
But you know what? I get it. I get that too, though, because yes, I'm a real person. Yes, all of the creators are real people, 100%. And I agree with everything you said. But at the same time, I get it because they don't know me. And you know who they really, really know really well? Storm. They know Storm extremely well, intimately well, in a way that no person can know anyone else in real life. And so me, just a name, doing something that is wronging this person that they care so deeply about, they're going to react very poorly, right? They're going to lash out. I get it. It doesn't make it the right thing to do, but I get it. That's all. I get it. I'm sure I know that as a reader, I have done it in the past. I might even not realize that I am doing it now in some other medium, in some other place, like with some TV show I'm watching, or with some, rock band that I like, where I'm ascribing, oh, the reason their new album sucks is because they this, this, and this, when it's like, no, you don't know what you're talking about. I mean, that's the biggest, that's okay, sorry. That's the biggest thing, is that the thing people get so upset about, one of the ones that was hardest for me was when people will ascribe intentions to me that I don't have, and they'd be like, oh, this is happening because Jordan thinks this, or because Jordan did this. And I'm just usually like, this person really does not understand how my job works, how making comics work, how any of this works, because that's not how any of this would go. Anyway, it's fine. I'm sure I do it too. I'm sure we all do it. It's fine.
Well, let's talk about another kind of fandom.
Okay.
Would you like to play a game with us?
Are you Jigsaw?
I am a little bit. So we interviewed Steve Fox, who is writing the current Dead X-Men storyline. Jordan, I don't know if you know that.
Oh yeah, I've
We
heard.
talked with him in a prior creator crush about recasting classic monsters as mutants.
Oh
You
goodness.
do a podcast called Nature Trail to Hell,
I
where
do.
you review classic horror movies with your friend Stefan Lawrence. So we thought we'd tweak things a little by having you recast classic horror movie villains with X-Men villains in a game
Okay.
we're calling So I Married an Ex-Murderer.
Ah, love it.
All right, so before we start, with respect to the name of your podcast, Nature Trail to Hell, are you a Weird Al fan as well?
Yeah, of course. Who is
Okay.
not, who isn't? We started the podcast watching the Friday the 13th movies, which Stefan had seen none of, and I've seen 27 times each or something like that. And we kept trying to think of a good title that was like a spin-off of Friday the 13th, or this, that, and the other thing, and we just couldn't come up with anything. And then at one point, Stefan just said, "What if we just call it Nature Trail to Hell after the Weird Al song, which both of us love?" And we were just like, "Yeah, obviously,
Excellent.
let's do that."
Excellent.
Although
Okay.
we did depart from it because now, like right now, we're watching the Saw movies. There's no nature or trails in Saw.
No. You guys have sold out. You lost your principles.
Yep, absolutely, absolutely.
We're going to give you a classic horror movie villain, and we
Okay.
want you to recast them with an X-Men villain.
Pressure.
And if no real villain works for you, we'll take any X character.
Okay.
So let's start with a true classic from the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Leatherface.
Okay, so Leatherface. Leatherface is a weird one because he's both like awful and horrible, but also like probably like weirdly innocent. Like they play him weirdly innocent in certain movies. Innocent, maybe not the right word. Gosh, who could that be? Maybe like Caliban? Like in that,
Oh, I like that.
I don't think he's necessarily like he's not evil in his like deepest, darkest core, but he's been just brought up into this terrible thing and manipulated into it.
Yeah, I definitely get a post-Arako nanny orphan maker type vibe.
Oh, sure.
Well, this family is certainly fucked up, and this kid has got a very warped view about like healthy relationships.
Absolutely.
How about Jigsaw, since you already mentioned Jigsaw?
That's the easiest one because it's arcade.
Arcade, yeah.
Like arcade, like I think we tried doing, I mean, well, more recently they did a Murder World book that was a lot darker with arcade. But yeah, I think at one point we tried to do like a more Saw style arcade book, and it didn't happen for whatever reason. It was not until this most recent one, which I think was able to ride a little bit of the Squid Game wave in order to happen, that a darker, a much darker, more twisted arcade. Well, I don't want to say only because Avengers Academy, but yeah, absolutely, Jigsaw arcade 100%.
Okay, how about Freddy Krueger?
Okay, so which way do you want to go with this? Like, so obviously we had Nightmare face off against the X-Men. So on some in some ways that would be an answer, but oddly, like Freddy like enjoys cruelty more than Nightmare does, which is a weird thing to say, but kind of true. Also, didn't they fight despair a bunch? I almost feel like that would be an interesting one, but he's again not doesn't have that like flamboyance that Freddy has. So maybe I just leave the like psychology, the into entering your mind part of it aside. Oh wait, Mastermind.
Oh, of
Oh,
course. Yeah.
yeah.
That's a good one, yeah.
You could go physically and say, Lady Deathstrike or,
Sure. Sabretooth or someone like that, yeah.
How about Jason, since you rewatched all of them
Oh
recently?
yeah, I love him. Again, it's some extremely like kind of easy, simple, almost dumb movies that I've thought about so much in my life, like spent so much brain power on. Again, kind of another like hulking near innocent, like a child who may or may not have been disabled when they first came up with him, but kind of became that over time. Who's like a big, I mean, well, actually, because you mentioned him, he's in my head, but Orphan Maker makes a lot of sense. Again, kind of childlike, but also incredibly destructive
And
because
his
of
mom was
what he
the
has.
first villain, so that would make Nanny like the first
Perfect.
Jason, right?
Perfect. Perfect.
Yeah.
Yep.
How about Hannibal Lecter?
Which one? You said
Let's
movie,
go with
so we're
Hannibal
talking about.
Lecter in Silence of the Lambs.
Okay, because I that's fine, but I cannot just talk about Hannibal Lecter without spending at least a moment talking about how amazing Mads Mikkelsen is. And again, I describe myself as a straight white cis man, but I was 1,000,000% in love with Hannibal Lecter in that show. Like 1,000,000%, I would have killed for him.
1,000%. 1,000%.
All right. So Anthony Hopkins.
I would, I'd allow, I would allow a Hannibal. I'd allow that if you wanted to cast that character.
Oh, that, I mean, it's a very different. It's a very different character to me. And they both are incredibly smart, but they have a different appeal. Let me. I'll just go with whichever one I come up with an idea for first. Let's see. Let's see. Let's see. Who's that kind of a
I mean, I definitely think that the
manipulator?
Hannibal in the show, he's a little campier. He's a little bit more, I think, refined, polished. The Anthony Hopkins, his feels a little bit more like a loner type in a way that is distinctive. And, he's in prison most of the time, so it's hard to not have that separation, but it definitely feels like a more classic serial killer. This person's acting on their own. They do their own thing. They're always going to zig whenever you think they zag.
Yeah, he's very sophisticated. I mean, I guess the thing is that they are both shown to be like master manipulators, and that's what I'm trying to think about. Who's the X-Men's biggest manipulator? And I've already used Mastermind. And like this is not a place where Mentallo will fit.
There is no place for Mentallo fits, I think.
the storage station at the very beginning of that run, but yeah.
Yeah.
Let's see. Let's see. Or what? And who's the other one? Who's the green one? Mesmero. There you go. But no, neither of them. This is a toughie. Okay. Oh no. People will hate me if I say that.
No,
Say
wait,
it.
okay. Yeah,
Say
come on, let's
it.
say it, say it.
Emma Frost.
Oh. Oh
That
my
is. Oh,
gosh. Okay,
wow.
I kind of stand this for the Anthony Hopkins a little bit. I kind of see it.
She's not actually a murderer. She's not like evil and cruel and enjoying people's pain as much as
Tell
all
that to Sunfire's horse. Justice for Butter Rum.
We revealed that she didn't really kill him. She just made her
I didn't
think
even
that.
think of
In my
the.
headcanon, she always did, though, but that's just for the jokes.
Okay.
I didn't even think of the Mads Mikkelsen when we were coming up with this, but I think he'd be a good, like a Mr. Sinister has that kind of like, oh, this is definitely like in a queer area, very dramatic, loves a panache, and will go out of their way to dick over someone they hate, especially if it's another doctor named Nemesis.
Yeah, I mean, I think we did play Sinister a little even campier than that. Like he's very over the top, and like I think Kieran's joke was that he added a bit of Deadpool to his personality or
Yeah.
something like that. So I hadn't thought of him, but you're right. There are times when he is not as silly as we sometimes have him be, that he would fit well with that. Yeah. He classically, especially, he was much more of a string pulling manipulator.
What do you think about Pinhead?
Okay, I've only ever seen one of those films, so I don't have a lot of insight into Pinhead. He's a Cenobite, and they are like, okay, again, one movie, one time. I think they are like demons who like love pain. Is that what it is?
Yeah, no,
Okay.
it's the whole thing. Their
That's the whole thing.
pleasure is pain. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So who is that? Who loves pain? I don't know. I mean, I almost feel like Sabretooth could fit into that because of how, I mean, although he's much more of I like torturing than I like pain. Although because he's got the healing factor, he can take lots and lots of pain and punishment. So, but again, I don't know. Does Pinhead do stuff?
Yeah, I mean, his whole thing is like artistically. I mean, you could certainly have the Happy Birthday bodies as being like a classic Cenobite type thing, for Logan's birthdays.
Yeah.
I
Okay.
get the
Sabretooth is a good one, actually. I didn't when we were coming up with this game, we were, trying to figure out which ones would fit. We didn't think about Sabretooth, but that works spectacularly well. Like he's into S&M. He just is. He's a sadomasochist.
What was the
Yeah.
name of Tarn and his group?
Oh, yeah. God, what were
Tarn
their
and the
names?
Nasty Six or whatever they were
The
called. No, no.
Locust Vile.
The Locust
Yeah.
Vile, yes, from Amenth, yeah, and Araka when it was over there. Yeah.
Oh yeah, they were messed up. I mean, Tarn is probably a much better fit for this. You're absolutely right. I'm sad I didn't
No, no,
think of
no.
him.
You don't put my answer higher. I came up with a game, so I've had time to think about
Well,
it.
so you have the real answers. You have the real answers, and that was the real answer, and I got it.
All right, the last one is we were going to suggest Candyman, but that's just replaced by Sugar Man. Okay, that's the end of the game. So I married an ex-murderer. That's the end of our creator crush. Jordan, thank you so much for being on. Is there anything else you'd like to plug?
Well, you already mentioned Nature Trail to Hell. That, like you said, that's a podcast. We did all of the Friday the 13th movies. We then did the Texas Chainsaw movies. We then did the Purge movies. We're just finishing up the Saw movies now as we speak. Not as we speak. I'm not literally recording the podcast while I record this one. And we're going to come back and do another season as well. And I don't know what we'll move on to from there. Hopefully, well, definitely another thing that's good. And the concept, other than just being horror movies, is that Stefan has not seen any of these. He's a big movie guy, but he just didn't ever get hugely into horror. So all of these franchises are movies that he's watching for the very first time. And most of them, I am his guide through them. I had only seen a couple of Texas Chainsaw movies before we did that season, but I really love it shouldn't shock you, I suppose, since I'm a comic book editor, but I really am fascinated by the like continuity of movie franchises and the way that they, especially that Friday the 13th, one of the things I love about it is how bananas the ongoing story is, because they're just making a movie and then going, oh, let's make another one. Oh, okay, now let's make another one. And it's like, how are you continuing the story? I adore it. I adore it for that reason. So it's a lot of fun. If you like hearing me babble, you can hear me babble more there. Other than that, I'm wrapping up X-Men. After that, I am in the process of moving over to the Venom series. They've
Oh.
just announced this big Venom War crossover event series for later this year. That's going to be super fun. Al Ewing is the mastermind of Venom and Venom War, and he's amazing to work with. I love that guy. And I've got a ton of cool people coming on to do the tie-ins for that. And also, I'm taking over the Incredible Hulk book. I've actually already sent my first issue of that. That's another one where the series is in place and it's running terrifically before I get there, and I'm going to try not to rock the boat. Philip Kennedy Johnson is a great writer. I enjoyed working with him a while back on the Marvel Zombies series he did. That was a real blast. And he's writing a really twisted, dark horror take on Hulk, and Nick Klein is drawing the crap out of it. And yeah, they're doing wonderful work. So I recommend checking both of those things out.
Love it. Where can our listeners find you?
Not really anywhere. They can find me in
Great.
the comics. I'm not really on Twitter anymore. I'm still on Instagram at Crackshot with a zero for an O, but it's me like posting pictures of like Lego builds and me hanging out with my son and stuff like that. Mostly not comic stuff. So you probably aren't interested. I also post whenever a Nature Trail Hill episode comes out. So you can follow me there if you're so inclined.
Fantastic. As for us, we're on Twitter at HomoSuperiorX and on Instagram at HomoSuperior Podcast. If you're listening to this, you probably already know that. If there are any other great writers, artists, or anyone else you'd like to hear us chat with, slide into our DMs or reach out to us and say we should interview such and such. We've been Homo Superior. Thank you very much for listening.
Thanks, bye-bye.